the Chinese.
As she was researching the building at 880 Hecate Street, she learned the property was up for sale and listed for development. She then knew she wanted to save one of the last remaining buildings from the lost Chinatowns.
We want to do the campaign now because the building looks like it's for sale to be subdivided into townhouses. And once this history is lost, it's going to be gone.
Sue says the Nanaimo Chinatown Heritage Foundation is trying to save the building at 880 Hecate Street with the hopes of being able to turn it into a multicultural community space.
So my vision is hopefully with that building, maybe that could be the recentering of a Chinese presence or a multicultural presence. Have it as a multicultural hall with First Nations storytelling. Have Japanese come and do, you know, like maybe tea ceremonies or just some cultural events.
With a price tag over $600,000, Sue says they have looked into grants and asked other philanthropy groups to help purchase the building. But many of the grants they're looking at require the building to have a heritage designation. Sue says in Nanaimo, the building needs to be part of the community heritage register.
And I was given the list of it by city planner. All the buildings are European and they're like Edwardian style buildings. This is where the coal miner lived with his daughter. And that's all, you know, very, you know, historical. How about the other cultures and the buildings and the spaces that they used, and how about putting some recognition for that?
To get started, Sue says the Heritage Foundation needs to write a statement of significance to the city of Nanaimo. If they get the designation, they'll start fundraising to pay the $614,000 price tag. She says along with applying for heritage grant programs from both the provincial and federal government, she has already spoken to many philanthropy groups who are willing to financially support a project like this.
There's the Chinese Canadian funders that want to preserve. Their whole mission is to have Chinese diaspora recognized. So there's funding for that.
While she's positive that they will be able to fundraise the complete amount, the Heritage Foundation is still asking the city of Nanaimo to fund around 10% of the cost, approximately $60,000.
The community has told me this is our space. We want it to have it as our space. Because in a way, it'd be the 880, the price for $614,000 is not insurmountable. So you could just go and just get enough funders to buy the building upright. But it's nicer, it's more reflective of the community if it's from the city of Nanaimo.
She says she's already sent out emails to mayor and council, as well as to city planners, to update them about what they're trying to achieve. As well, the Heritage Foundation is gathering research and testimonials to work towards the goal of saving the building.
We're at the point where July is when we do the heritage statement. So we've got all the research and people's stories coming out, and we're going to present that as to ask to be on the registrar, and then a delegation for September to ask mayor and council, could we ask you to save the building and maybe purchase part of it so it's under the city of Nanaimo with other funders. So that's pretty much the timeline.
Sue says she continues to talk with people and hear the history of the Chinatowns as she sees the importance of saving these buildings.
It's worth it for me to put aside my sleep, my weekends, my summer to see if this can be done. I would be very sad if it's not preserved, because then shuts that down, that piece of history down, and says that, well, do we need this history? And I would be very, very disappointed.
More information about the Nanaimo Chinatown Heritage Foundation can be found at www.nanaimochinatownheritage.com. For CH1 News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Thank you again to Lauren McKenzie and CHLY for that news piece. Coming up next, we have a track from the local band Chopping Spree. This track is titled Catch Yourself. Thank you.
you can feel yourself if you can catch the groove. You can find yourself if you can catch the groove. Take a chance and feed your mind, you ain't got nothing to lose. Follow the footprints and you'll see. You will love yourself if you forget the past. Gotta make amends if you want something to last. Treat your body right, all you gotta do is ask. Yourself.
Is Bird Note. It's hard to think of a more lowly regarded bird than the pigeon. But as Rosemary Mosco writes in her book, A Pocket Guide to Pigeon Watching, people and pigeons go back thousands of years and were beloved by royalty. Akbar the Great, ruler of the Mughal Empire in the 16th century, kept over 20,000 pigeons.
Akbar the Great would have visiting dignitaries watch his pigeons fly around, and his hope was to sort of subdue them into awe and, you know, have them want to do business with him.
And in parts of Europe, from the Middle Ages onward, pigeon owning was a privilege.
Like in France and in the UK, you were only really allowed to have pigeons if you were a royal.
England stopped enforcing this pigeon exclusivity in the mid-1600s. But over a century later in France, peasants who built illicit pigeon houses were still being forced to destroy them. Meanwhile, the elite's pigeons were allowed to fly into peasants' fields and snack on their crops. So pigeon ownership became a flashpoint in the French Revolution.
When the poor rose up, one of the things they did was they smashed all of the pigeon houses. And the people in charge desperately passed through these measures that said that, yes, okay, the poor can keep pigeons.
Pigeons are no longer exclusive to nobility. But next time you see these birds, consider giving them a little more respect. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
All right, to end off this hour of Speak Up, we have one last interview. An interview I did a couple of weeks back with someone by the name of Ava Quissy, who is currently hosting a series of death cafes around East Vancouver. Death cafes are a community event series where people gather and talk about death, whether that's through, you know, personal experiences or just the concept of it, as a way of just making it lighter, making it easier to talk about. So, as always, thank you so much for tuning in this hour. Make sure that you tune in tomorrow for Intravenous and for Speak Up again on Thursday. But I'll see you next week. Thank you for tuning in. Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvitarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Death is an inevitable part of all life, but also something that not many people feel comfortable discussing. That's understandable. It's something that we can never truly know, and that's a scary concept to contend with. However, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be talked about, and for many, talking more about death can be something that is healing. That is what certain gathering events, dubbed death cafes, are trying to show. The Death Cafe, as it's structured today, has been around for over a decade, originally hosted by a man named John Underwood in the UK. Since then, variations of the Death Cafe have been hosted all over the world, including right here in Vancouver. Recently, CJSF was made aware of a Death Cafe series being hosted twice a month at different venues around East Vancouver. We wanted to learn more and got in touch with the lead organizer, Ava Quissy. Ava Quissy is a recent SFU graduate of political science and someone who, after speaking with her, clearly loves talking about death. During our conversation, we spoke with Quissy about why she started these death cafes, some of the conversations it's created, and how talking about death doesn't have to be so scary. Please take a listen.
My name's Ava. I'm actually also an SFU graduate. But I host Death Cafes in Vancouver, which I've been hosting for about a year now, on and off. And it's something I'm really passionate about, really interested in conversations around death and grief and community building. So, yeah, happy to be here.
What made you start organizing these events in the first place?
Yeah, so I actually took a class at SFU, HUM3, oh man, what's the course code? Okay, I forget, but by Jason Brown, and he taught this class called Death, Disease, and Disaster, something like that, and it was all about, like, culture's response to tragedy, death being one of those things, like, thinking about how cultures understand death and such, and that just, like, ignited all these themes in my life that I had kind of been suppressing for a long time about anxiety around death and conversations of grief and change and such. So through taking that class, I came across death cafes, which I ended up doing as a final project in that class, and just read about it, and I was like, this seems amazing. So I did a death cafe with a small group of friends, like six people in my friend's house, and it was just super, super moving and just a really beautiful experience. And I was like, everyone must experience this. So then a little while later, I started doing them publicly, and now I do them for anybody and everybody.
Mm-hmm. Whereabouts are you doing them? Is it, from what I saw online, it looked like you kind of switch venues?
Yeah. Yeah, I've done a few different venues, which has been interesting because depending on the venue, like, you can obviously get different people. And it's been interesting to see how it's changed as I've facilitated in different spaces and tried different things. But I've done the Slice of Life at East Cafe, at Secret Lantern Society, all based in East Vancouver. And then in the future, I'm hoping to do some outside and do some cool, like, collaborative events. So especially as the weather gets warmer, to, like, be in an outside space and have these discussions. But yeah.
And what are these discussions? You know, when I saw the premise of a death cafe, is it sort of tailored towards people who have experienced death and are going through a grieving process, or people just wanting to talk about the concept of death in general? How does that work?
Yeah, so the Death Cafe, there is, like, an actual format, kind of like quote-unquote, comes out of England, like 2011. This guy, John Underwood, he started this official thing called Death Cafe, which is a place for people to come together and talk about anything related to death and grief. But it has some guidelines in its traditional format of, like, there's no prompts, it's group-led discussion, it's not bereavement counseling, like, it's a safe space for people to come together and, like, enjoy snacks and connect and just, like, talk about the philosophical and interests or experiences, whatever. But yeah, I mean, every Death Cafe is different, and it morphs to the needs of the community. And definitely, as people host death cafes in Vancouver, and I've seen different death cafes happen, people play with, you know, those rules. So I definitely have used prompts before and such. But it's really, like, it's for anybody, it's for anything. Yeah, like, I feel like people typically come and talk about experiences with loss. It is typically more oriented towards, like, a grief-sharing kind of style event. But I definitely have people that come in and are just want to talk about funeral planning, especially if they're, like, a bit older in age. People come in talking about pet loss. People come in talking about, yeah, like, theoretical interests or religion. Like, there's so many different things. So, you know, as long as the space is safe and respectful for anybody, then it really can just be anything. Yeah.
Do you think death isn't talked about enough? Do you think that just, you know, I mean, obviously you host these death cafes, but just, yeah, on a societal level, it does feel in a lot of ways like a taboo topic, mm-hmm, something that provides a lot of discomfort for people. And is that part of what these death cafes are trying to quell or combat?
Yeah, that's definitely where this comes out of, right? The Death Cafe is a response to particularly, like, the global North or North American culture having a very sanitized relationship with death, medicalized relationship with death, and how we've been so separated from traditions and, yeah, I mean, experiences with death culturally. So, and loss, I think, like, just being, I don't know, intimately acknowledging how present loss is in our lives and all the different ways that we experience loss. So the Death Cafe definitely comes as a response to that need and that lack. Yeah, I definitely don't think it's talked about enough. I mean, my whole basis for being interested in this was feeling such anxiety around it when I was a child. And especially as we live in an increasingly, like, secular and globalized world, especially in North America, which is this crazy combination of traditions and, you know, a new culture and, yeah, navigating all of this. I think a lot of people feel like maybe a little bit lost in the dark in some of these discussions, and especially from the discussions that happen in these events, I think a lot of people feel really alone in their experiences. So I have just, every time there's a Death Cafe, the response is so overwhelming and how connected people feel, and that always just points to how deep the need is. And so, yeah, I think there's always more room to talk about these things, for sure. Yeah.
How do you feel like your perspective on death has changed since starting these?
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit in a Death Cafe I had the other day, where sometimes I'll vocalize in the Death Cafe, I'm like, oh, people will think that, you know, because I'm in these spaces, yeah, like, what does it mean to always be in a space where you're kind of thinking about death or talking about death with people, you know? But Yeah, I think maybe for a certain time, I almost did it as like a defense mechanism. It's like I had this anxiety and it was like, okay, well, now I know I have to face this anxiety. And maybe by facing it, you know, I can overcome it. But it's not about overcoming it. Like, I think I've really had to come to terms with the fact that, like, I'll always be scared. I'll always have fear, and there's always an unknown, and I can't do anything about that. And that is kind of the essence of the relationship. It's accepting the unknown, and it's accepting that I can't control these things, and making peace with that in my human experience. And so I feel like that's kind of been one of the bigger lessons of just like, I have to face this. And that doesn't mean that I'm more prepared for it. It just means that I'm like facing it, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I think it's not something that, like, death isn't something you experience and then all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm better now. Like, yeah. I've healed. It's like, totally. It's an ongoing process. And yeah. It's just, these spaces are sort of meant to, like, commiserate and come to terms with that process rather than, like, quote-unquote, overcoming it.
Totally.
In a sense.
And it's interesting to see people talk about grief, like, often people will use like kind of like fighting words. It's like to fight my grief, you know, to like overcome my grief. And I don't know, you know, like everyone has their own way of making peace. But I think it is about making peace, you know, like our grief becomes a part of us and it morphs and it changes. And how do we incorporate that into our lives in a real way rather than like pushing it away? Yeah, it's interesting to see the language that people use around it. But yeah, like how can you prepare yourself for the death of your friends and family? You know, I don't know that it's about being prepared or it's about being ready. You know, these things are supposed to be devastating. Like that is the importance of them, you know, like that's the way it is. But recognizing that devastation in community is so, so, so important. And so, yeah.
What is the mood like at these events? That was something I was curious about, because the way you talk about it, it feels so, I guess for lack of a better term, positive. Mm-hmm. Like you sound very positive when you speak about it. And I'd imagine that these can be kind of heavy at times, but what is just the overall mood and tone of these death cafes, or maybe the tone that you try to convey?
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I definitely talk about it and I'm like, my friends are like, oh, how did the last death cafe go? And I'm like, oh, it went so well, you know? But it's like, these people are, you know, like we're crying together. And it really reaches such highs and lows in, you know, in positive ways. But it's a full spectrum of emotion. And I always frame it that way going into the space. I always tell people that this is a dynamic space where crying and laughing will happen. And like all of those things are okay. Grief and loss and our feelings about death encompass, like, there's so many different ways that they manifest. So to go into an event where we talk about those things and expect to only be sad is just not even a reflection of what it's like to actually experience those emotions, right? Yeah, so I mean, it definitely has, obviously, it's very sad, slow, heavy moments. Of course, there's a deep and intense sharing, but there's just such a community that's created. And leaving, I feel like I'm hugging strangers, and it's like there's such a beauty in that heartache. And yeah, it's kind of almost indescribable sometimes. That's how it feels for me, at least. I feel so filled up by it. Sometimes I get kind of anxious before the events, and then when I leave, I'm just always so moved, always. Yeah.
Do you find that it's been sort of the same people reattending, or is it always kind of a new crowd wanting to speak on death?
Yeah, there's definitely people that come back for sure, which is awesome. And it's been interesting. Something I've been passionate about is creating more of an intergenerational space, because a lot of the death cafes that I attended before I started hosting publicly were maybe a bit more themed and a bit more oriented towards people that were thinking about end-of-life planning and such, which is super important, of course, or thinking about funeral planning. But I was really curious, especially just from my own experience, to tap into the thoughts and feelings of people more in my age group. So creating the intergenerational space has been really interesting, and in seeing how those conversations, like what conversations have come up. And then seeing like my friends show up and like not tell me about it, or like people that I've kind of met, and realizing, yeah, that there is such a need. Yeah, it's also, yeah, like I said, you know, different spaces, different people. So I'm always kind of surprised sometimes. And it's gotten to a point where I do have people that I know show up and they're not telling me, and I'm just like, okay, this is nice, this is a good thing. But I'm finding new ways to try and get the message out there to new groups, because it's really a space for everybody. Like, I think everybody can benefit from being there. So
yeah, I mean, the intergenerational aspect seems like a pretty important part, because, you know, I'm assuming we're both in our 20s. Mm-hmm. And like, when you see when there are older people attending these events, like, it's kind of a fact of life. Like, once you get to a certain age, like, you are going to have experienced death.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, or like the death of loved ones in your life. So like, having those people there, providing that kind of perspective for people that are younger and maybe haven't had those experiences yet, or had fewer of those experiences, that feels like a very important part.
Totally. And I think it's like, what does it mean to live the width of your life, but also the depth of it? And we, like, it's so easy to make, you know, relationships with people that are on the same kind of time frame as you, like in your circle. But having relationships with people that have more life experience and less, you know, younger and older, there is something so, so essential about that. And yeah, I was reading about this, like, beautiful indigenous perspective about, like, living your life to become a good elder or a good ancestor. And I talked about this a little bit in my death cafe on Wednesday. And I think we've become really alienated from that idea. Like, we get really caught up in, like, what's happening right now and how do I live, you know, especially in this youth-obsessed culture, which definitely bleeds into this fear of death and fear of loss and change and aging, you know? What does it mean to have vibrant, healthy, inspiring relationships with people that are older than you, and to, like, have that reciprocal inspiration of, like, life doesn't end yet, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much taboo just around aging. So I think they're all intertwined in my eyes. And yeah, you want to live every moment as fully as possible, and having those relationships and those insights, I think, really plays a big hand in that, for sure.
How can people who want to learn more about the Death Cafes, like, when they're hosted? Yeah. Where? How does that work?
The promo. Yeah. It's a little bit low key right now, but I do post them on Instagram. That's when I host mine. I host, yeah, out of various spots in East Vancouver monthly on my own, and then I co-host with a friend out of Playground Studio. Also trying to do that monthly, but so you can check out Playground Studio, because we posted it on there. And then I have an Instagram called Looking Out, Looking In, which is where I just post any of my little death related journey stuff. So I always post on there, and then it's also on Eventbrite usually as well. So yeah, keep an eye out.
Once again, that was our conversation with Ava Quissy, host of a Death Cafe series in East Vancouver. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations. Postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca. The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access@sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.